Rick and Morty forever and ever. Rick and Morty, 100 years, rickandmorty.com. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the newest episode of Nerds on the Rocks. As you can guess by hearing my voice first, Earl is gone, and Justin and I are running the show again today.
We killed Earl.
Oh, I'm James. Say hi, Justin.
Hi. We killed Earl.
Yeah, we did it. We finally took over the show.
Finally.
It's going to be about literally everything we want. So yes, that means we're going to let Justin's going to make a Ruby episode. I'm going to make a Wes Anderson episode. So everything's going to fall apart.
My dreams are coming true. All right. So let's get this started then. Awkward silence should get cut. First thing, yesterday I watched Kick-Ass 2.
Really?
Yeah.
How was that?
It was not as bad as critics had said, but also not as good as I've heard from some other people. So, you've never seen, did you see Kick-Ass 1?
Yeah, I love the first one.
Yeah, the first one's really good, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's basically this, but just 8 times more vile, so it starts off like Dave's training to be a superhero. It's like 2 years after the first one, and he meets like this group of people who are like inspired by him. There's like this ad copywriter guy who becomes a superhero called like Dr. Gravity or whatever. There's this gay kid who goes around like saving people who are outed. And who doesn't wear a mask. And there's this family couple who like team up basically because their son was killed. And then there's this other guy who used to be a mobster and then became a born again Christian. And then there's some other girl who Dave hooks up with whose name I don't remember. But it sounds kind of interesting. Just they do things that most superheroes don't do, and that they give back to the community. Like there's this one scene where they work at a soup kitchen. They help girls get home safely, like if they're drunk. They beat up drug dealers, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's things like that, the quote-unquote like human moments that make the film watchable. But it's just after a certain point, it gets to be like Mark Miller-esque and gets like really fucking dark and weird. Like, did you ever read the comic?
I read the comic for the first one, and it definitely felt like it had a serious tone problem.
Yeah, the tone problem definitely comes with this movie. So, like, there's this one, so, like, you know, there are the scenes where the heroes are together, they're reciting, like, their little anthem, and they're, like, being really super heroic and saving, like, these girls in, like, this Chinese sex ring. And then, like, maybe half an hour later, McLovin, I forget his bad guy is like called the mother. His name is called the motherfucker as a bad guy. He basically like wears his mom's sex, BDSM stuff,
mm-hmm.
And so he finds the identity of the girl that Dave sleeps with, and then he tries to rape her, but he can't get an erection. It's things like that. And I distinctly remember them saying that they weren't gonna do that in the film, like, around press time.
Mm-hmm.
So this was unexpected, and also really unneeded. Like, I can't imagine anyone laughing at that in the theaters.
Mm-hmm.
It's like
just that kind of trying to provoke for the sake of provocation.
Basically.
Without any, like, greater point to it, so basically. It ends up just coming across as, like, insufferably juvenile in the worst way possible.
It basically is. I should also point out he didn't end up raping her. Like his henchmen just beat her up. I feel like I should point that out too. All
right.
Yeah, but it's those moments where it's like it's got this weird, disturbing, jarring shift in tone. That it'd be like if you were watching The Dark Knight and then you turn to an episode of South Park where Cartman like farts in someone's mouth for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Or like there's this other part. Hit Girl is trying to, like, establish herself as a high schooler.
Yeah.
So the film's, like, way of doing that, of trying to, like, show her be this teenage girl, is to do the Mean Girls thing if it was written by Seth MacFarlane. So she
Oh.
gets, yeah, which is a high praise. So it's like she gets ditched at this part. Originally, I thought that the dude was gonna try and rape her, and she like bashes brains in, but that's not what happens. The quote unquote hottest guy in school ditches her with all these other girls who don't like her because she like outperformed them at this dance, at this dance tryout, and then she gets this machine, and she taps them with it. It makes one of them like literally shit themselves, like visibly shit themselves through their skirt, and then she touches the other one. That one like pukes on the head bully. And then she touches the head bully, and like she pukes and shits at the same time, and it's just the most disturbing, jarring thing ever to see. I'm not selling you on this movie, am I?
No, I was very hesitant to see it after liking the first one, not really hearing very much of anything good about the second one. And, I'm going to keep this in the continue putting off until I eventually, 7 years down the line, I'll like look it up on some internet article and remember, oh yeah, they made a sequel to Kick-Ass.
I should point out, I watched this just because it was on. It wasn't because like I had like a strong desire. It wasn't because I had like a strong desire to see it and never got around to it.
It was because your DVR deleted Wolf of Wall Street?
Yeah. It's basically like, oh, I saw Kick-Ass 2 and be like, oh, I never got around to that, so I DVR'd it and then watched it the next day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But the jarring tone aside, it is a serviceable movie.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't. It definitely feels like it hates itself a lot more than the first one. Like the first one had those moments where they were definitely like trying to take a piss at themselves, but they had a heart about it.
Yeah.
This one has less heart.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like that scene in Guardians where Chris Pratt is like giving that speech, and then Rocket would just like laugh at him or call him a jackass. It's kind of like that.
Yeah, it's sort of like that, but they never then came back around and made it work.
Yeah.
I gotcha.
Also, I feel like it would be Jim Carrey is also awesome in this.
Mm-hmm.
For a short time as he's on. And I feel like it would be in DC's best interest to hire Chloe Moretz as Stephanie Brown, because she definitely like has the look for it.
Mm-hmm.
If/when they ever get around to that. Have you watched any movies lately?
I actually have not really. Like, what was the last thing I got around to seeing? Because I've sort of fallen out of watching any movies or TV lately.
Uh-huh.
Shit, I think the last thing I saw was, I rewatched Alien 3 last week.
How's that?
Assuming we're going by the extended cut, it's actually pretty damn good.
I haven't seen either version, I should put that out there.
Yeah, for those who don't know, Alien 3 was one that was had a lot of heavy studio problems just in production. It went through several different rewrites and people on it. Like when David Fincher of Fight Club and Zodiac fame, who was Gone Girl is coming up later at the beginning of October, when he finally came on to Alien 3, did not have a complete script, sets in production, and the whole time it was constant studio interference for the actual end result of what the movie would be.
What was the studio trying to do?
Basically, they were just constantly trying to interfere with the general tone of the movie. Like the general, the ultimate result of film in Alien 3 is nihilistic. Like, it basically said, "Is no rip, are never getting out of this. You are always going to be hounded by xenomorphs. They are always coming for you. You will die." And it does end in a way that reinforces that. So it's a movie that is a ultimate bleak note. It's the, at least in that way, it ends in a way that's the perfect finale for the Alien franchise. Unfortunately, the theatrical cut ended up excising a lot of the screen time given to the secondary characters, who now feel remarkably less established. So yeah. So it ends up, and it also tones down a lot of the religious elements, since the film takes place on a prison colony, mm-hmm. where some of them have started taking to religion in order to bring them comfort in the world, and the theatrical cut ends up toning that down dramatically.
I see.
But yeah, the extended cut, not sadly not a director's cut, because David Fincher was so frustrated that he basically swore off talking about the movie. It rarely shows up on any of his like on any of his DVDs, if they list like selected works of him, uh-huh. it never lists Alien 3, and he didn't come back for the re-edit, so it was basically just a couple people sort of re-edited it based on sequences to get more in line with what he was trying to do. So the assembly cut.
Is it like the Wachowskis and how they feel about The Matrix, where they just like do not talk about the last two Matrix movies?
Sort of, yeah. It's actually not a bad comparison. Of course, they sort of got. I want to say they got what they were trying to do, but they maybe realized that they lost control of their own vision and things went out of hand, so maybe that's why. But thankfully they've recovered since then with Speed Racer and Cloud Atlas. But yeah, Alien 3, well worth checking out the assembly cut. I think every copy now comes with that version. Like, I know the Alien Anthology they released a couple years back that has all four of them has that extended version. I think most DVD prints of it do. So yeah, it's definitely worth checking out.
All right.
Especially if you are a fan of David Fincher's movies or the Alien franchise, and you maybe skipped it by for some reason or another.
Like the only Alien I've seen, Alien 1, and if we're gonna go by rules or established quote unquote canon, then Prometheus are the only two that I've seen.
Yeah. Yes, Aliens is also reasonably worth checking out.
Yeah, I hear that 1 and 2 are the really good ones, and then you skip 3.
Yeah, well, I support 3. At least the assembly cut, anyway. And 4 depends. Okay, basically the problem with 4 mm-hmm. is that you had a director and a writer who were trying to take it in completely different directions. So I think the director was Jean-Pierre Jeunet, who was aiming for a very psychosexual angle, mm-hmm. which does fit because, I mean, the aliens are literally a sentient penis alien monsters.
Right.
And then you had the screenwriter, Joss Whedon, who was going for a bit more campy tongue-in-cheek tone in line with what he later did in Firefly. Mm-hmm. So the two of them combined together just does not work. So it is a very bizarre cluster shard of a film.
I like that. You mentioned Alien 3 had side characters who didn't ultimately mean much.
Yeah, well, in the extended cut they do, but yeah, theatrical one, they get cut down almost completely.
Speaking of characters who ultimately don't get much, who are, like, side characters, there's the Assassin's Creed news. Have you heard about this?
Yes, I heard there's going to be, like, a secondary content.
Yeah, so...
As context, for Assassin's Creed Unity?
Yeah, so what it is if you get the Assassin's Creed Unity Season Pass, you get two pieces of DLC that come with it. One of them is just some Arno DLC, and the other one is this 2.5D game called Assassin's Creed Chronicles China.
Mm-hmm.
And you play as this female Chinese assassin called Xiao Jun, who was apparently in the Assassin's Creed Numbers film.
All right.
Yeah, and I think most people with the brain can agree that it was included with Unity in particular, because after earlier this year.
Yeah, with all the frustration with the response to why there were no female characters in Unity.
Yeah, like I really couldn't afford it, or it was just too hard, didn't have the technology, it was something.
Yeah. What they should have said was, well, you're always playing as the same guys, yeah. So. Because that is the ultimate thing. You're basically just playing as a recolored version of the main character in the co-op mode.
Yeah, basically what it is. Like, I don't have a problem with them sticking it to just one guy. I mean, it's disappointing, but I'm not going to, like...
Yeah, when you have someone trying to make a different answer,
yeah.
And yeah, shooting yourself in the foot.
If they had started with that answer, I would have been totally cool. But I'm more annoyed and offended at the excuse that they gave us instead of, like, their actual reasoning. If they had said that, I would have been totally cool with it. I wouldn't have liked it, but I at least would have understood their methodology. So now, there are some people, I guess me included, who don't like that that China Chronicles is being added in this. And there's some people who have taken to Twitter and such, being like, oh, but you guys wanted a female assassin, and you didn't buy Liberation, and there are no female assassins in Unity, so you can't complain about this.
Wait a minute, you're saying you're saying I should have bought a Vita game?
Yeah.
People want a Vita?
Yeah, let's buy a Vita game that Ubisoft totally didn't market at all. Or you know what, let's buy the one that was released on PS3 and 360 that they also didn't market. You remember that?
Wait, which one?
The
other one coming this year?
No.
Liberation.
Yeah, that was last year. Like they
released
it basically with no marketing.
Yeah, which to be fair is about the amount of marketing every Vita game gets.
No,
so.
No, not for the Vita.
When they re-released it on consoles, yeah.
Like there was absolutely no marketing on it at all.
Yeah, and from what I could tell, like quality-wise, it was pretty middling within the series. So it is bizarre that they even did bother porting it over.
Well, I mean, even so, I mean, I guess they tried to like recoup some losses that they probably made with the Vita version.
Yeah,
but like even so, it's Assassin's Creed, and they don't not market Assassin's Creed.
Yeah, Assassin's Creed is a massive, massive franchise.
Like, if they had Assassin's Creed branded underwear, you know that they would market that shit out all the time.
I would be concerned too, as much. You know what? I actually believe at this moment there probably are Assassin's Creed boxers. I'm actually going to look for those right now.
There probably are. There's probably Assassin's Creed playing cards, actually.
They do not appear to be Assassin's Creed boxers. Wait!
Oh, wait, I think there's Assassin's Creed playing cards.
I think I found an Assassin's Creed... Yep, I did find Assassin's Creed underwear.
No way.
I think this might be from someone's, like, custom-made boxers, but yes, I did find...
Find my cafe press?
It's called AliExpress, so I'm assuming this is not official merchandise.
Probably not.
Just guessing from the very provocative picture they have of the man wearing it. I'm going to assume this is not official marketing product of Ubisoft.
Probably not. But anyway, getting away from provocative man packages. And getting back onto Assassin's Creed. Like, the issue that people have with it, the issue that I have with it, is that it's not that, you know, it's a game with a woman set in China, which is a place that people have been asking for.
It sounds like a pretty neat place to set a game. I mean, granted, French Revolution sounds like an awesome place to set it, too. But...
Right. The issue is that, and this is a problem that Assassin's Creed has had since basically 2, is that it's... The main game is basically like a white-ish looking dude getting to do stuff, and the minority characters are getting relegated to like either to just like downloadable content.
Yeah, to supporting roles or DLC. Like they had you're like second in command in Black Flag, and they then spun off into a DLC.
Right. So, and it's like women in games are such, and it's weird because I feel like Assassin's Creed has more female fans than any other franchise, like short of Bioware stuff that I can think of.
Yeah, of the AAA franchises, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that part of that is because even though all the games star men, they don't feel as overtly hyper-masculine as a lot of other AAA blockbusters.
Right.
And I think that helps alleviate a lot of it, which is probably partially why a lot more people are more... are a lot more assuming that at some point they are going to make one of the mainline games star a woman.
Right.
Like, it would be more, I would be less surprised seeing Assassin's Creed game with a woman on the cover than I would, say, the newest Call of Duty.
Right.
Just because it's not made in such a masculine-centric light.
Right.
So, yeah, I think it definitely speaks to sort of just a general, less that it specifically is the problem, more that it represents a larger issue. With the fact that there are an embarrassingly poor ratio of gender in games.
Yeah. There's like around the same time that the Assassin's Creed thing was happening at E3, Ubisoft also said that they had considered making the main character in Far Cry 4 a female. But I don't remember their exact logic behind not doing so. I remember it was a bad signal for Ubisoft.
Yeah.
And part of that was also because Watch Dogs had come out, and the motivation for the things that you were doing in the game was basically because your niece was a plot device who ended up getting murdered.
Yeah. Well, I forget. I think your wife died at the beginning, and then
it was your niece. Your niece died, and then your sister got kidnapped at the end of the game.
Oh, that was your niece who died. I was confused. Okay.
Really?
I only played this game like 3 months ago, and then I marathoned the entire Uncharted trilogy right after that. So I might have had the quality whiplash might have been big enough to make me forget some of the plot details. So.
Watch Dogs didn't have much of a plot from what I could tell.
Yeah, Watch Dogs has a lot of neat things going for it. It's
plot is not one of them.
Yeah, it's plot. It's handling of gender and racial dynamics are definitely not among them.
Yeah, Ubisoft has for a company which has a team which is like comprised of various different like faiths, ethnicities, and beliefs. They're not really good with like gender and racial stuff in their games.
No, they're not.
Like, remember
it is especially.
Did
you
play Far Cry 3?
I did play Far Cry 3.
Yeah, so that entire thing is just like 12 hours of like constant white savior syndrome.
Oh yeah, and it's especially odd because I don't know. Did you play Far Cry 2?
No.
Okay, it actually sort of subverts that sort of white savior colonialism stuff in a way.
Really?
Like, partially because you can select from a couple different characters, including one who's actually Sikh. And also because they basically admit that the involvement of you and the other, and like the villain who's like a white arms dealer,
mm-hmm.
basically makes the entire situation in the country completely worse. So they actually sort of worked against a lot of the stuff that Far Cry 3 ended up playing straight.
Uh-huh.
And I think. Because I remember correctly, the protagonist in Far Cry 4 is an Asian American male, correct?
Yeah, so
it feels like that's partially them trying to get away from it, but at the same time, still.
Yeah, that's definitely what they said, too. They wanted to try and, like, turn that on its head because they did receive, like, a ton of criticism about that.
Yeah.
For 3.
And it is good that they're learning from their mistakes, yeah.
Yes.
But at the same
having said that. It's
still the Westerner coming into the Eastern country and riding an elephant through their fortresses.
Not so much that, because for one thing, that part's awesome. But I think...
Yeah, exactly. Riding elephants sounds awesome.
Right. But no, I think the mistake was like having the box art be like this pasty-ish looking guy. Like,
yeah.
But to be fair, people did jump the gun on that one. But even so, it didn't paint the company in a good light, where it's like this gay or metrosexual-ish looking dude is like sitting on a throne and there's like an Asian man next to him holding a grenade and definitely looking like he's not having a good time.
Yeah, he's not exactly having the nicest day there.
Yeah,
it's like this French guy has me here in this on this mountain. This isn't good. Here we are, making a sandwich, selling real fake doors. This is not good. It's actually a fairly tone-deaf box art. It's like, okay, I can see this imagery working, but
mm-hmm.
as a box art, yeah, just, as a box art without any other context, it comes across as remarkably tone-deaf, which sort of describes a lot of game marketing.
Oh, God, I'm trying to think of something else that happened recently, which was, like, really bad in its marketing approach.
Was it like how, what's that franchise, Onichanbara, at Tokyo Game Show, you
oh
actually
my
played
God.
It?
Did you see
Like, the booths were inside, like,
giant
underwear,
like,
I think?
No, it was, like, giant, it was, like, a giant woman, and, like, you got to put your head inside of her boobs.
Mm-hmm.
And, God, Japanese culture is just so interesting, because they're way more sexualized than we are, and we're more violent than they are.
Yeah, but at the same time, there's still a certain amount of that sex, but not like not too much in a certain way.
No,
like they still still censor penises out of their porn,
right? Well, no,
for example,
well, no, with them it's sort of like it's kind of like a 10, like how an 11 or 12 year old would approach sex, like
yeah,
sort of like just sort of like childish awe,
just like boobies.
But then, like, with here, we get kind of, like, creepy and possessive, but with them, it's just sort of, like, childlike, and they don't really know what they're doing, and no one's just bothered to, like, call them on it.
Yeah. And,
Remember that, Oculus? Did you hear about that Oculus game? It's the one
the
where, like,
porn one?
it's the one where you can, like, squeeze her boobs, and she gets, like, really uncomfortable.
I think so. Was that the one that had the vibrator attachment controller?
Yeah, no, but it's like
Okay, that was a separate porn game.
yeah,
There
no, it was.
are many, many porn games for the Oculus Rift, and all of them make me uncomfortable because
There's a surprising, oh, I don't want to say surprising, but there's a good enough amount to make me not want to have anything to do with Oculus for a while, unless I like live alone and I'm in desperate need of some quote unquote human contact.
Yeah, I suppose on this subject, yeah, Tokyo Game Show is happening. Haven't seen much coming out of it.
I just seen the
I know they
Final
showed
Fan
off,
I seen the Final Fantasy 15 thing like a
yeah.
billion times.
Yeah,
And
it's quite pretty.
I seen all the memes about it too, like of the four dudes being in the car, then someone's just like, "Get in, losers, we're going adventuring."
Yeah, it looks like you're just like taking a road trip across some modern-ish world that also has fantasy stuff. Like,
That's
it's not like as hyper future as Final Fantasy 13.
basically. You've seen Zoolander, right?
No.
Oh, there's this one part where Ben Stiller and these three guys just like driving in a car and like bopping their heads back and forth, and someone made a GIF of like the four dudes from Final Fantasy 15 doing that.
Nice, but yeah, Final Fantasy 15.
They said there are a lot of memes
15 has
about
a demo coming next year along with the HD re-release of Final Fantasy Type Zero,
that
or
is.
maybe it's Type O. I don't know.
No
I
one
don't
knows.
know how to pronounce most Final Fantasy game
I
names.
just call them Final Fantasy.
I don't even know what this. Oh, I think that was one of the spin-offs of Final Fantasy 13 that they all announced when they announced Final Fantasy 13, because you should always announce your spin-offs as the same day as your main game. And Final
How many
Fantasy
Final Fantasy
15,
spin-offs are there at this point?
a lot.
No.
Like, there's the entire Tactics series, there's the Theatra Rhythm Music ones, there's like All the Bravest, the Four Warriors of Light, Dissidia, the sequel, there's like the
Christ.
direct-to-video sequel to 4, all the sequels to
Ooh.
7, think, oh yeah, 10-2, Crystal Chronicles, Mystic Quest, what the hell is Urgeist?
You can just say a lot.
There are a lot. Yeah, Final Fantasy 15 actually started out as a spin-off of 13.
Yeah, wasn't it supposed to be like,
Yeah,
dang it,
it was
what was it
part of that.
called? Was it 13 Arena?
It was some obnoxious name. Yeah, it started out as Final Fantasy Versus 13.
That there was,
And
and then
it was
Eddie.
announced at the exact same time. It's from basically the team in Square Enix that makes Kingdom Hearts. So it's like that from that core development group, and they've been working on it so long that at some point they just thought, you know what, we've already had two actual sequels to Final Fantasy 13, let's just make this the new one, so it won't take forever to get to Final Fantasy 15. And that's basically the plan, and that game will come out eventually.
Yeah, I mean, Final Fantasy 16 probably won't come out until like both of us are dead of old age.
Yes, we will be dead. It'll be right after I actually play a Final Fantasy game to completion.
Yeah.
I'm like, I
So
finally got
basically,
around to finishing 6, guys. And then we'll be.
I liked what I saw of 15. It
Yeah,
looked
15 was pretty neat.
real-time combat, which I've always wanted it in a JRPG.
Yeah. Yeah, look, it definitely looks to have a battle system more akin to something like Kingdom Hearts,
Yeah,
which makes sense considering the people behind it. So let's see.
I have like one or two more things to talk about, and then we can move on to your thing.
All right.
All right. Well, I'm not gonna get into this too much, but I watched the premiere of Gotham.
All right. Yeah, I think we're gonna be talking about that on a later episode, but what's your initial impression?
It has potential, but there are two things about it that, well, I guess more, it's just more the one thing about it that really bothers me. And I think you already know what it is.
Think I do.
You want to guess?
It's astonishingly on the nose, and it's wink nudging at people who are going to be future Batman characters.
Jesus Christ, dude. It is incredible. So, like, the first. The show basically opens with, like, with a young Selina Kyle. I think she's, like, 13 or 14. She robs these two people. She takes the guy's wallet, and then she steals the middle woman's milk. And then they literally show her just, like, giving the milk to a cat. before he just, like, slinks off.
Wow, this is...
It's that... Oh, it gets better. It gets better. There are, like, two references that are even more obnoxious than that. One of them involves the Riddler, where basically Gordon's, like, friend Bullock tells him just, like, to stick to... It's like, I don't have time for riddles.
Mm-hmm.
Like that. And then there's this other one. There's this other one, which is a slight spoiler, where Gordon goes to Bruce Wayne's house, and he sees, like, Bruce Wayne on the roof, kind of looking like he's about to jump, but then they go inside and talk, and Bruce, and, like, little 12-year-old Bruce Wayne is like, I want to learn how to master fear. And keep in mind, this is, like, a 12-year-old kid who saw his parents get gunned down, like, a day or two ago.
Yeah, he's like, and darkness.
And he's already talking about mastering fear. It's like, what the hell is wrong with you? You're a sociopath.
Yeah, it feels like this is a show that its quality is very dependent on how much they can just make it on the characters who exist at that time and make a compelling show out of them, and how much that they can resist the urge to just make it, just waking up the audience, hey, this guy becomes a Batman villain later.
It's incredibly obnoxious. Like, there's also this one other part. Penguin is in the show, and he's basically just, like, the lead woman's, like, little crony. And so, him and, like, her, a few of her gangsters are just sort of, like, messing around with this dude. They're, like, beating him up. And then one of the guys is like, you want to try a cobble pot? Yeah, sure. It's like, he hits the guy once. They'd be like, don't go crazy there, Penguin. And he's like, please don't call me that. It's that kind of stuff. It would have been one thing if it, there's, like, this promo where someone, like, says, you know, dude, you walk like a penguin, and he kills them. Like, that's fine, but having people, like, he gets called Penguin, like, two or three times, it's that kind of, like, ounce of trying too hard.
Mm-hmm.
I'll try to think of a good analogy. It'd be like if in Spider-Man, like, you always saw Peter, like, kind of sticking within close proximity of Mary Jane or Gwen Stacy, and then when someone's been like, dude, don't be, like, sticking to walls trying to listen to her conversations, man.
Yeah.
That's basically what Gotham is like.
Okay, so it's in the maybe pile at the moment.
Like, I will give it, like, another two or three episodes. But, like, that aside, the pilot was good. But it has, like, the typical pilot problems of, like, trying to establish too much. There are too many characters.
Uh-huh.
But if the second, like, third episode's good, I'll keep watching. Otherwise, I'll just give it a pass.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Now, James, it's boxing time.
Yeah! Boxing season is upon us, and I actually don't know if it's boxing season, but...
I think every season is boxing season.
Probably, but boxing feels like, given that it is predominantly an indoor sport, and/or one fought in underground fight rings, that you really aren't so dependent on the weather as you are with other sports.
Nope.
So, but boxing is probably year-round.
But sadly, but apparently this movie is not year-round. It only comes out this Friday.
Comes out this Friday. If you don't see it then, it's gone forever. It's the Box Trolls. The newest movie from Leica Animation, previously of Coraline and Paranorman. And both of which, if you haven't seen them, are respectively really good and excellent. So definitely worth checking out. And I guess sort of spurned by the Box Trolls upcoming release, or I guess release at the time that, by the time this posts probably, I thought it'd be nice to talk about some of the other stop-motion animated films that have existed throughout the years.
I haven't really been that much. I mean, I don't know if you would, like, classify Wallace and Gromit as stop-motion.
I would. Yeah, it's definitely stop-motion.
But it was like that and the other two that you mentioned aside, what stop-motion films, like, have there really been?
Yeah, it definitely is a far rarer form just because it requires even more extreme patience than traditional animation, since it requires you to craft this small but highly detailed thing and then move it inch by inch, frame by frame, over the course of 5 minutes to where... like, I guess a lot of the prominent use of stop motion animation is sort of outside just animated movies and just uses older style effects. So, for instance, Ray Harryhausen used that for all his monster effects in his movies. So stuff like Jason and the Argonauts, the Sinbad movies, Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, mm-hmm. all of those contain a variety of really quality stop motion monster work. Like Jason the Argonauts in particular has the final battle with the skeletons that is just fantastic. Yeah, and as far as fully animated stop motion films, the big one, of course, is probably The Nightmare Before Christmas, which is, depending on who you ask, it will determine how much Tim Burton involvement there was. For what I could tell, he basically put together the basic story and core designs.
Yeah, from what I hear, that's like really debatable as of late. So either he produced it, or he only directed it, or he only showed up at the script reading for it.
Yeah, for what I can tell, yeah, he was at least from what I've seen, he basically was the one who put together the basic story and like core designs of it. But the actual like day-to-day direction of the animation and the voice acting and whatnot was primarily handled by Henry Selick.
Mm-hmm.
Who then went on to work at Laika and make Coraline, as well as James and the Giant Peach along the way. And James and the Giant Peach, I don't think is a good movie.
I don't think a lot of people actually remember that movie, because I know what it
exactly.
is. Yeah, it's a Disney movie. It's one of the weirder Disney movies, like, visually.
Yeah, just because, yeah, that's one thing that stop motion always, just because of the jerkiness of it, it always tends to lend itself a bit more to more...
Well, not so much the jerkiness.
Horror-tinged stuff, I guess.
Not so much the jerkiness, just, like, the design of some of the characters. Like, I remember there was, like, a caterpillar, like, who kind of had, like, one of those, like, what would you call them? Newsies caps, I guess?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
And, like, a cigar or something like that. It was just really weird to see. It was, like, so, at a
and then they
age.
Do battle with a robot shark at one point.
Yeah, and wasn't there, like...
And then they go underwater to find their compass and fight an army of skeleton pirates.
Yeah, I remember that part. And then wasn't there something where they had, like, a dance party inside the peach?
They did definitely dance inside the peach.
Okay, good. I'm not crazy.
And then, unlike in the book, where his parents were just killed by a rhino that escaped from the zoo, here it was like a magic rhino that hangs out in the clouds, and then it came back in the finale.
Yeah, that movie was weird.
It was weird. We're not actually sure if it's a good movie, but it's also a movie where you get to see a gorgeously animated robot shark.
Yeah, I need to...
So consider it a worth checking out, even if it's not actually good.
I should probably watch
like,
it again.
I should fully clarify, I love just the look of stop motion animation so much that I'm willing to watch movies that aren't actually that good. trying to think of some others. I guess you mentioned Wallace and Gromit. You got anything else to say on them? Because I really like the recent movie they had for them.
I haven't seen the recent stuff. I remember Cartoon Network had like this 3-movie deal with them. I remember one of them was like Wallace and Gromit and the Wrong Trousers.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, Gromit, it's the trousers. They've gone wrong.
Yeah,
I think it was like robotic pants or something like that. It was something.
Yeah, I think that was it. Yeah,
I don't remember like if they ended up being robotic or like someone did something to make them robotic, but it was just a really weird thing, which I just found the funniest thing ever in a movie.
Yeah, I know. The first one I saw was one where they had ran out of cheese, and since of course the moon is made of cheese, they decided to build a rocket ship to fly up there in order to get more cheese.
And wasn't there like one with like. Where they fought, like, chicken or sheep?
I think so. I know the recent feature-length movie they had,
It was the Were-Rabbit.
First, the Were-Rabbit involved, of course, Were-Rabbits stealing crops and stuff, and that was pretty neat.
Right.
That was, I'm trying to remember this too. I think that was Aardman Animation, who then also made Chicken Run back in the late 90s.
Oh my god, Chicken Run was awesome.
Yeah, Chicken Run is basically The Great Escape, but with chickens.
Yeah. Okay. So, Wallace and Gromit films, there was A Grand Day Out, The Wrong Trousers, A Close Shave, and A Matter of Loaf and Death.
That is a great name there.
So the most recent... Oh, was 2005? God, so long time ago.
Yeah, and, I guess my favorite stop motion animated movie is probably The Fantastic Mr. Fox. another same as James the Giant Peach, Roald Dahl adaptation, helmed by the great Wes Anderson, one of America's finest filmmakers today. And it really is, like, besides just being a goddamn delight, I mean, it is a great movie at understanding sort of that feeling of like middle age inadequacy. It's one of the great midlife crisis movies. Mm-hmm. And of course, you also get to see and you also get to have George Clooney and Meryl Streep as an animated Fox couple. So I mean, there are at most like three other movies where that will happen. So
what do you think is like the most distinct visual style that you've ever seen?
Or I guess.
The one that you enjoy the most.
Like from any movie or stop motion in particular?
Just like from media in general.
I honestly feel like it might just be like all of Studio Ghibli stuff. And it is like partially unfair because they are the best, but I mean, screw it. When you're that good, you earn the right to have a little bit of an unfair constant preference towards you, those guys, who are sadly no longer making movies for the indefinite future.
Yep. I don't remember. Did they ever say why they were closing down?
I think it was partially because like their last movie or two were not very financially successful. Okay. A lot of their big directors are getting older. Mm-hmm. They hadn't really cultivated a lot of younger talent, and these are very very time consuming and financially expensive projects to undertake in order to get them at the same quality, because unlike a lot of anime studios, they don't like hire out animators from other countries in cheaper places like Korea or anything. They do it all in the house. So it just reached the point where everyone was too old. There wasn't enough money. It just had to take an indefinite hold. So at least for the moment, Studio Ghibli is over. They do have two more movies yet to come out in the U.S. Tale of Princess Kaguya is coming out later this year.
Isn't the other one coming out next year? Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's when Marnie was. That's when Marnie Was There is coming out. Right. So I think that's the name, is it? Yeah, I know Kaguya premiered it again at Fantastic. Or showed a bunch at Fantastic Fests, mm-hmm. which is probably over by the time this is happening. And I guess of the other things that seem to be getting a lot of excitement out of there is Tokyo, which I have basically heard described as a dystopian martial arts rap opera.
That sounds kind of awesome.
Yeah, it's basically about a group. It's basically about a Tokyo controlled by several rival rap gangs, who then fight it over. And one critic described it, the closest thing we'll ever get to a Jet Set Radio movie. Yeah, everything I've heard about the movie is basically says it's the single greatest thing ever made, so that's coming out at some point next year.
Okay, what is Jet Set Radio? I've heard people like say this before. I never played it. I don't know what it is.
It's a Dreamcast game. That's why you've never played it.
Oh, well, I wonder.
Yeah, it's...
where is the Jet Set... Jet Set
Radio? I think it's like a game about like someone on roller skates who just like goes around spraying graffiti and fighting the power, I guess. Like visually, it's certainly super cool. It's got that same cel-shaded look as Wind Waker and others have. So I'm not entirely sure how it plays, but it's certainly one of the more visually distinct games out there.
There aren't really that many visually distinct games. Like, there are games that like have a specific art style. I feel like cel-shaded is definitely becoming more and more of a thing. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you have Borderlands, you have The Darkness 2, you have, like, Sly Cooper, things like that.
Yeah.
And I guess you also have Crackdown.
Mm-hmm.
But those are all, like, very much influenced by something. Like, Darkness is influenced by the comic. Sly Cooper is sort of, like, influenced by those old, by, like, noir or Looney Tunes cartoons.
Mm-hmm.
And Crackdown is in some way influenced by comics as well, just because of the whole superhero motif that they have going. But Borderlands is, art change isn't really, from what I can tell, inspired by anything.
It was just
like, we want to make our game different, so we spent like 3 months doing it.
Yeah, they were like, we realized our game wasn't looking that great, that awesome, so we decided to just spruce it up, and then it looked amazing.
Which is fine, because I mean, it definitely helps the game like have its own sense of style, and it helps give the world like personality.
Yeah. While still as I sort of felt playing through Borderlands 2, sort of having an actual decent amount of heart to it.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was sort of surprising when I felt playing through it.
Yeah. So I'm a fan of cel shaded. Like I basically grew up playing Sly Cooper, and their cutscenes are sort of inspired by like comic books and very cel shaded esque. The whole franchise is kind of like Looney Tunes meets Assassin's Creed, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's sort of what I've heard. Yeah, stealth platformers.
Yeah, I wouldn't really call it a platformer. It's like stealth, open worldish almost.
All right.
Not like open world in the sense where like you're hijacking vehicles or stuff like that, but it's open world and like all your missions take place in the city and you go from like mission to mission. Or you can like do whatever mission that you want in whatever order.
Right. Necessarily sandbox.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. I have been meaning to check out Sly Cooper because I really like playing through the first Infamous. So
yeah. The first three made by the same people, and it's really interesting to like see the three big like PS2 franchises like Ratchet, Jack, and Sly, and then you see like where they went to with the PS3 and PS4.
Yeah, was it Resistance, Uncharted,
and
Infamous?
And it's like so there's like Spyro and Crash, then there's Ratchet and Jack and Sly, and then there's like Uncharted and Resistance and Infamous, and it's like this weird jump in maturity and tone.
Yeah, it is definitely hard to describe. Like, hey guy, I just sort of want to go back 15 years ago and be like, hey, did you know that the guys who made Crash Bandicoot are going to go on to make one of the most thematically and emotionally effective games ever made?
Right.
I mean, most likely what they're going to say is games can be emotional. Is probably what they're going to be saying circa 1999.
Right.
It's like, no, really, it's going to have like actual meaningful gender politics and like worthwhile gay characters. It's crazy.
Right. Or it's going to be like, okay, now you're playing the dragon, but in, like, 15 years, you're going to be playing with, like, this cat thing with the robot on its back, and he's got, like, enough guns to take down the entire, like, United States government if you try hard enough. Do you ever play the original Jack and Daxter? Or, like, any of the original of those franchises?
No, I haven't. Wait, have I?
They're very much...
No, I haven't.
They're very much products of their time. Like,
mm-hmm.
Jack 1 is basically just, like, collect the thing.
Yeah, sort of the successor to that N64 collect-a-thon platformer.
Basically, like, you need the power orbs to, like, get to the next hub town, is more or less what it is. Ratchet is kind of directed where it's like, you have objectives, now go do the objectives, and here's also some side objectives. And then Sly is kind of a mix between both, where it's like, you have this sort of, like, hub area, and then you have, like, these portals where you go and actually, like, do the objective, which is, like, basically every time it's go get the key.
Yeah.
And I think Sly is the only one that's really, like, stayed the same in terms of, like, its general tone. Because, like, Jack evolved from, like, slapstick to sort of, like, this fantasy epic involving time travel. And Ratchet went from, like, two dudes to, like, trying to save a planet to, you know, saving the galaxy to... saving the fabric of reality, and back to Smartoscope stuff. But Sly is basically not so much like hasn't changed, but hasn't tried to like overstep its reach. If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. I see what you mean. Yeah.
All right. I was actually gonna ask you something else, but I don't remember.
Persona 4 is very, very good.
Tell me more about Persona 4, James.
Let me tell you about what's good about Persona 4. I think everything. At least thus far, everything. So.
Thus far, everything. That's it.
Yeah, there you go. That's your Persona 4. Okay, I think it's a JRPG for people who have more of a preference for the Western RPG style of storytelling anyway.
But it's still, like, turn-based-ish.
Yeah, it still has a turn-based battle system, crawling through dungeons. But at least narratively, it's structured a bit closer to the Western style. Like, it's not about... It's less, like, in terms of making major choices that influence it, and more the... I'm trying to figure out the way to fit. More that it's a little bit more centered on direct interactions with characters that you initiate rather than a strict linear progression. So the actual, like, collective experience along the way is more varied. I guess it's sort of like an in-between between the Western and Eastern styles of role-playing game design. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely one that I would recommend for those who are a bit more hesitant about JRPGs and are looking for something to sort of tip their toes in the water.
I'm not sure if my thing with JRPGs is just, like, because I hear that, like, it's super long and they take, like, forever to get into, or if it's because of, like, the gameplay, or it's because because, like, what we were talking about earlier was, like, the Japanese culture is just, like, really weird.
Yeah, it's just so...
I think it's a mixture of all four of those.
Yeah, I'd say Persona is probably a reasonable jumping in point just because it does, like, move away from a lot of those problems. I guess another one would probably be Chrono Trigger, which is another one that has... that sets itself just enough apart to feel a bit more welcoming to those who are hesitant about a lot of the JRPG tropes. And I suppose Dark Souls, but
I wouldn't really call that a JRPG, though.
Yeah, it's one that is a JRPG and from Japan, but yeah, it's definitely not rooted in the JRPG mechanic mindset.
I wouldn't really call it RPG. I don't think I'd call it an RPG either. I think it'd just be more like straight up, not like action, but action RPG-ish.
More adventure-centric, I guess.
Yeah, or action-adventure, perhaps.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd probably fit it into RPG, but yeah, I see what you're saying.
Yeah. Granted, I also haven't played a ton of it either.
Yeah, that's also something worth checking out.
I played a little bit of Demon's Souls. I played, like, maybe a half an hour to an hour of Dark Souls 2, like, at a friend's house. I just haven't taken the time to, like, play it for real.
Yeah.
Part of that's just because I have other things that I consider, like, a higher list to play.
Mm-hmm.
And the other part of it is just the Dark Souls fandom is kind of, not to generalize, but just, like, super annoyingly smug. They have the PC gamer problem where they're just, like, irritatingly smug, and it just, like, turns you away from the thing that they
where they are the worst salesmen of what makes... Sort of what I felt with the same way with Game of Thrones, where it feels like they're selling the misery and pain way too much when that's not at all what makes it compelling.
Right.
Like, it's just a fan base that's really awful at marketing what makes this thing good.
Mm-hmm. It'd be like if a business salesman was like, oh, I'm gonna let you have this, but first I'm gonna tell you, but first they make you read the contract. That way, like, you know all the penalties, you know that you have to play that, you have to pay, like, the exact moment that they say so, and that wouldn't inspire you to buy the product.
Exactly.
Have you ever played Earthbound or Shovel Knight?
I have not played Shovel Knight. I played the opening of Earthbound, and I do want to try out more of it, because that's another one that at least in terms of, like, story tropes, falls outside of the usual JRPG fantasy sci-fi norm.
Yeah, that's because you're a kid.
Yeah, I think someone described it as basically Peanuts meet Lovecraft.
That sounds all right. I think that's exactly what I heard, too. It's always weird when, like, childish or childlike games have, like, this weirdly dark undercurrent about them. Because it's super...
Like the Kirby series.
Yeah. It's like, in Sly Cooper, you have, like, this enemy who's been hunting your family, like, literally your family line down from generation to generation. So he's basically a serial killer. And, like, as a kid, you don't really think much of it, but then when you're an adult, you're just like, wow, this is really fucked up. It's always sad when you're an adult, and then you realize that, like, the things from your childhood are just, like, dirty joke after dirty joke. Or it's, like, it's this metaphor for something which is, like, really screwed up in the head. Don't ever be an adult, is basically what we're saying.
Yeah.
Adulthood is overrated.
Yeah. You put off being thrown out by your parents as long as possible, kids.
Yes.
They will appreciate it.
Exactly. Which is why I won't be moving out until either I lose my garage door opener or my parents change the locks.
Awesome.
whichever happens first. And since my garage door opener is always in my car, it's probably going to be until they change the locks. Or they call the cops on me.
That could also happen.
And I don't want them to call the cops on me, so I'm going to move out as soon as I can.
Good thinking.
Yeah. On that note of stalking your parents until they literally force you to move out or call the cops,
it's time to go. This has been Nerds on the Rocks episode 188, I believe.
Sounds about right.
So, thank you, Justin. This is James, and we'll see y'all later.
All right.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.